Thanks for coming. I'm glad we were able to wait until everyone was back from their travels. I'm going to start with a problem. You may have come across this problem before, or you may not. In any case, it's a good problem for talking to your friends, especially non-physicists, in the pub. So here's the problem. This is the Elitzer-Weidman bomb problem. So here's the setup. There's a factory. Okay. And this factory produces bombs. Okay, so here's a bomb. So the bomb has a handle on it. This is the bomb part. I was explaining this to my 4-year-old daughter. But then it becomes balloons, because bombs are too terrible. Every bomb has a trigger. So here's the trigger. Let's get a bit longer. There's the trigger. And this trigger is so incredibly sensitive that if a single particle of any kind whatsoever touches the trigger, then the bomb will explode. Yeah, that's the setup. Now, the only problem is that this factory, their manufacturing process isn't quite perfect. And so sometimes what they output is this. The trigger part is simply missing. So the question is it possible, you have lots of these bombs being produced by the factory, is it possible to produce an ensemble of bombs that you know have the trigger, and yet you haven't exploded them? Because it would seem that the only way to see if the bomb has a trigger would be to send a particle on it, but then the bomb explodes. So I call these good bombs, but putting inverted commas around it because of the obvious moral thing. And then these are bad bombs, again. So the question is, can we collect an ensemble of good bombs which still haven't exploded? And it doesn't matter if we explode some bombs in this process, this testing process, as long as at the end we have some good bombs that haven't exploded. So there's just a problem. We'll come back to that. It's a nice way of illustrating the usefulness of quantum theory. So this course will consist, roughly speaking, of three parts. And I was going to have it so that we'd have one of these parts each week, but now all the schedule is messed up, and so we'll see how it goes. But roughly speaking, the first part will consist of sort of novel effects. So there's lots of interesting novel effects in quantum theory, and by looking at these and thinking about them, you get some intuition as to what kind of theory quantum theory is. It's good for just getting established in thinking about sort of these sort of quantum effects. The second part will be sort of conceptual and interpretational issues. And this is really what everyone thinks quantum foundations is about. Things like Bell's theorem or the measurement problem, which I think you've covered already in Joe Emerson's course. And then also the various interpretations, such as many worlds, de Broglie-Bohm. There's a whole host of interpretations that we'll look at. And then the third part will be sort of more structural issues. And So this is probably a very big subject to encompass, you know, things from quantum logic, various reformulations of quantum theory. I'm going to look more specifically at general probabilistic theories. Reconstructions. And some reformulations. So quantum theory is an example of a probabilistic theory, and you can sort of set up a framework for probabilistic theories in general, which admits not just quantum theory, but also classical probability theory, and then in addition to that, more general, potentially more general probabilistic theories. Reconstructions, these are where you take some set of axioms or principles, postulates, that seem well-motivated, and then attempt to rederive the structure of quantum theory from those starting principles. And reformulations are just different ways of reformulating quantum theory to try and gain insight, and they're useful for different applications. So I'll talk about just some of that. But today we're going to look at sort of novel effects. And in particular today, I'm just going to look at interferometers. So maybe I should use. Okay. Bring my book here. So interferometers are a very nice kind of quantum situation to look at because they lay bare a lot of the what is going on inside quantum theory. So what I'll do is I'll first set up the sort of building blocks for just a simple analysis of interferometers. It's sort of like Lego, things you can stick together to make interferometers of different types. Okay. And first of all, I'll treat just one particle. Okay. So we have a source. Which prepares a single particle state like this. I should say I'm really happy to accept interruptions at any point during these lectures. So please feel free to interrupt me at any point. Maybe prolonged debates on the interpretations of quantum theory we'll try to save for other times. But in general, I'm very happy to accept interruptions. Okay, here's a few more building blocks, a mirror. I'm going to stick with the policy. Well, it's almost a convention that you put an I when you have a reflection. That turns out to be useful, especially when you look at beam splitters. It's just a way of keeping all the mathematics in place. It doesn't really matter what you put here. Depends on the construction of this beam splitter. But if the phase was different from I, just a slight change in the path length that followed the mirror would make it like this. Oh, and this is the same for a mirror like this as well. We have a path length. In general, I'm going to set L to be a multiple of the wavelength, so that we can ignore any phase associated with path lengths. It's just equal to the, to unity. This is a phase shifter. And so if we're interested in the phase effects of a particular path, then we'll insert a phase shifter that we can vary to pick up on that. Okay. And a beam splitter. So this is just a particular choice of how to implement a beam splitter. But you can see that I've continued this policy of putting an I on reflection. So here, for example, A is reflected into D. Here we have A reflected into D. So we have an I there. I should also say that R, these two numbers have to add to one. Actually, they can add to less than one, in which case you have a lossy beam splitter. Yes, please.
So that should you have a 2 pi there in L, e to the I 2 pi L?
Oh, yes, sorry. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And secondly, so you said it's a convention, but I mean, how does it pan out eventually, like I, y? Just because of the phase factor, or is there
which one are you talking about? This one here?
The reflection.
So this one here, we could also go with this. It doesn't matter. In experiments, when you do experiments, there is a phase shift associated with the mirror. But you're more likely to see that if you're just bouncing straight off a mirror.
Yeah.
We're always sort of grazing it at an angle like this. But the point is, since you can always put a phase shifter here and a phase shifter here, put this whole thing inside a box and call that a mirror. It doesn't really matter. I just adopted this particular convention. The reason being that inside here, it is important to get a consistent. For a beam splitter, you do need to be consistent. So for a beam splitter, what's important is that the overall matrix here is unitary. This matrix is unitary, and actually any unitary matrix will do here. I like this convention because, and again, you know, if this isn't quite what you want, you can always put phase shifters in there to deviate from this. So just calling it a convention isn't quite right. It's just a useful choice. Any more questions? It's worth saying every now and then you see in the literature someone making a mistake. This used to happen especially in the early 90s, perhaps, when people were less familiar with this, and using a matrix here which isn't unitary. For example, I think you quite often see people putting a minus sign here and here. And if you do that, then you can set up superluminal signaling. So you know, one of the fun things to do in this field is to read papers where somebody claims that you can signal faster than light using entanglement, and find the mistake. And you know, sometimes it's the wrong choice. Yeah, sometimes it's more interesting. The no cloning theorem, which I'll talk about maybe in the next lecture, is a response to one of those proofs of someone trying to signal faster than light. Okay. Oh, so this is unitary. So in particular, what that means is that this is zero, and it sort of goes to zero under this transformation. If you take the inner product of this and this, you also get zero. I'm not going to do this sum, but if you put this into here, then that goes to an inner product, which is also zero. I won't do the sum. It goes to zero under this transformation. Okay. And then we have detectors. So the most common sort of detector is going to be this kind, where you have a particle coming in, and the detector is initially in the blank state, in the sort of ready state, you know that by a zero. And then the particle is absorbed and the detector fires. So this is the state saying that the detector has fired. Okay. Sometimes it's useful to consider a detector like this. So as the particle passes through the detector, which is initially in the ready state, the detector fires. Okay. But those are all my basic building blocks. Any more questions?
No. Is it possible in your detector? Isn't there a possibility that it doesn't fire? And
so, so you mean like real detectors? Sometimes they don't click.
Oh,
so
these are all ideal.
That's right. Yeah. So my attitude here, and for most of these lectures, is going to be just to take sort of ideal cases where that clarifies things. Yeah, for sure. If you want to treat real situations, then you have to depart from this, and you have the problem. You have both problems. In fact, you have the problem that sometimes the detector doesn't fire. The efficiency is less than one. Then you also get dark counts where the detector fires, even though nothing hit it. Yep.
Are we saying the state doesn't change after detection?
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And that's possible. That's possible because this is a unitary. This is an allowed unitary transformation. This can be embedded, let's say, because this is just one question. But this can be embedded into a unitary transformation. So there's no problem with having this. There's some debate in the literature where people say, well, you know, any measurement has to disturb the momentum. And so surely that the momentum of the particle has to be disturbed afterwards. But so far as this kind of process is concerned, that's not really true. You can always, in principle, set up a unitary transformation that will allow this to happen. Again, in practice, it's going to be difficult. And any real detector will probably disturb this state afterwards. But we're trying to keep things as simple as possible so we can just look at the basic structure here. Any more questions? Okay. have my first, well, maybe it's worth doing a zeroth example first. Kind of messes with my notation, but okay. So I have a source. I'm going to try and use the same letter for the detectors as I used as for the paths. Okay. So here's detector A. So obviously this is simple. We just have a, it's just if you press this button. Oh, I forgot to mention on the source, I imagine there's a button that you can press. Okay, and then it emits a particle. This incidentally is far from trivial to realize in a real experiment. We're idealizing here, so this is the most trivial experiment you can imagine. You press the button, and this detector fires. Okay. So that's my zero example. First example. Okay, so just imagine we have a source. We we press the button, the particle comes out, and then it goes to the beam splitter. Well, it's worth, I mean, this is obviously trivial, but it's worth just doing the calculation. So our initial state, oh, for some reason I've changed the notation. I'm going to change this notation for my own convenience. Okay. So A, particle comes in into path A. So our initial situation is like this. And now this evolves. Well, A evolves. Let's see. I can also put the phase shift as well. Okay. And now we can ask, what's the probability of detecting the particle in different cases? Well, the probability of getting, let's just do one more step. So you can see what happens is you end up with some probability for getting detector B click and detector C not click. And you get some probability. The other process. And the phases, of course, don't matter, which is what we expected. And really, if this detector clicks, then whatever you do over here is not going to influence this probability, and vice versa. The other thing, of course, is that the particle is only detected in one of these two places.
There it's theta c?
Theta c, yeah. Did I put that in here? C. Yeah. It's kind of trivial stuff, but it has, in some sense, it's this fact that the particle is detected in one place or the other leads to the measurement problem. The fact that although you have a superposition of two things, in actual fact, what you see is one or the other. Okay.
Question for the moment: what are we doing with time evolution and Hamiltonians? Or just
so really, I've given you all these unitary, all these processes. All of this would follow from a Schrodinger equation if you were to set things up in that language. I've just given you discrete time steps. And the one thing I've done in particular is I'm always going to treat this path length to be equal to an integer multiple of the wavelength. So I'm just ignoring it. Yeah. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So a more general example you can consider okay. Get my notation right. Sorry, I drew this up too. Okay. So particle, it goes in. This is called a Mach Zehnder interferometer. It goes through this interferometer, and then through the first beam splitter, you have two phase shifters, and then it goes through the second beam splitter. So I'm not going to do this calculation in full, but it'll be in one of the tutorial assignments or homeworks. Let me just treat some simpler situations. So I have here now two beam splitters that are both 50-50. So R is equal to a half. So this is a simple example. State comes in state S, evolves through the first beam splitter. So we have I two into V plus into U, sorry. Right? And now it evolves through the second beam splitter. So we have to take this through the second beam splitter. So U gives us, well, U is reflected into D, or is transmitted into C, so it's, and then it's reflected into D. Now this one, V, is it's reflected into C, let's get this right, and it's transmitted into That's, is that clear? Yep. And if you just go through, you see that, oh, there's a mistake here. There should be an I here. Okay. So here you get a minus one, and here you have a plus one. So this whole thing is equal to C, basically. And what that means is that, you can even get rid of this of the I if you want. I forgot to include the I on the mirrors. It doesn't really matter because it's the same for both legs. So what you see really is if you send a particle in to path S, it always comes out here if these two path lengths are equal. If both of these path lengths are, in this case, we're treating them to be integer multiples of the wavelength. Okay. Oh, and there's one other thing. It's worth looking at this. There's something interesting here that appears throughout quantum theory. You sort of get this effect that a quarter plus a quarter equals one. What I mean is, you see the probability of arriving here, if you just think classically, along this path is a quarter, because you have a half here and a half here. Here is a quarter. The probability of arriving here along this path is a quarter too. And yet, the particle always ends up here, even though the two probabilities are a quarter. And that's because what you really have to do in quantum theory is add amplitudes and then square. So you can think of it like this. You have square root of p. When you have constructive interference, you're doing this. And that's twice as big as the classical effect. In the classical effect, you just have P. Let me move this board up a bit. No square is 2p. Yeah. So the quantum effect, when you have constructive interference, gives you something twice as big as the classical effect. Okay. Okay, now what I want to do is put a pi phase shifter here. And if you do this, and just go through the maths again, what you find is instead of getting C, you get D. Maybe with a phase shift, I can't remember. So in that case, if you have a pi phase shifter here, when you send a particle in here, it always comes out here. And the same is true, of course, if you have a pi phase shifter in here as well. The same thing happens. And so it's interesting to look at these experiments, and you can just give a basic argument as to why the classical model in which a particle goes one way or the other fails. So you're familiar with this kind of argument, at least in the context of the double slit experiment. We can give the same argument in the context of this Max Zender interferometer. So imagine particle comes through here, and then it decides with 50-50 probability to go this way or this way. Okay. And then it reaches the second beam splitter. Okay. If the net phase shift in these two paths is zero, then the particle has to go into C because of this experiment over there. Whereas if the net phase shift is pi, the particle has to go into D. However, if you imagine the particle just goes along one of these two paths, this one, for example, it has no way of knowing whether the net phase shift was zero or pi. So it doesn't know what to do when it reaches this beam splitter. And so you see that a sort of single particle model simply has to fail. You can take this kind of very simple argument and sort of build it up into an argument for the reality of the wave function. This is sort of telling you that in some sense, something has to go along both paths at once. So now we could imagine introducing a detector into one or even both of these two internal paths. Let's just do it in one. In this case, if we do the calculation, we'll see that we no longer get destructive interference. We don't get any interference. So I'm not going to do this, but it's worth doing as an exercise. But now you have to be careful to include this internal detector state, and you'll see that this causes the interference to be wiped out. But there's an interesting effect, which I won't have a chance to cover, called the quantum eraser. Which is where you do this in both paths. And, sorry, I'm getting my convention wrong. You do this in both paths, and so you lose interference because you've detected which way the particle went. But then you can recover interference by performing a measurement on these detectors, which destroys the information as to which way the particle went. So it's a sort of an interesting, but maybe I'll put that in one of the tutorial assignments. Okay, so now the solution to the problem we started with, the bomb problem, is probably obvious to everyone. So what you do is you take the bomb by the handle, and you place it so that the trigger, if it is present, protrudes into one of the two paths, like this. Okay. Now, what happens in this case? Well, there's various things that can happen. One thing that can happen is just thinking sort of in a simple way, that the particle could go along here. Let me start again. Let's just look at what can happen in the output. One thing that can happen is that the particle is detected here. Another thing that can happen is that the particle is detected here. Another thing that can happen is that the bomb explodes. Okay. If the bomb explodes, then we're out of business. We have to try again with another bomb. If the particle is detected here, well, we set the interferometer up so that even if the trigger isn't present, the particle will always be detected here. So that doesn't tell us anything. On the other hand, if the particle is detected here, if this detector fires, the only way to explain that is that there must be some obstacle here. In other words, that the trigger must be present. So what that tells us is that we have a good bomb. If this fires, which is kind of remarkable. So that's the solution to the bomb testing problem when you're trying to entertain your friends who didn't pursue a career in physics.
How do you know the bomb won't fire every time?
Fair enough. Let's actually do the calculation.
No, I mean that, again, it's a very interpretational question, that say that the wave function passing the trigger won't explode the bomb.
Oh, okay.
The particle will passing the trigger will explode the bomb.
Let's do the calculation and then we can see. Okay, so the calculation is, let's call the bomb. The bomb is, I guess, B. Okay. And so we start off with a system state S and the bomb. Let's assume we have a good bomb and the bomb hasn't fired, so it's in its sort of ready to fire. Ready to explode state. And then we go into here, and now we have I'm just gonna so this is just a 50-50 interferometer. So we're just evolving past the first beam splitter. Now let's go past the bomb. Well, we have two terms. And this term will explode, because here we have the particle in this path about to hit the bomb. Okay, I don't know if the particle, let's assume the particle is absorbed, so we don't care about that. And then the second term, well, the bomb won't explode. And then we can evolve this now past the second beam splitter. And so if you look down here, there is a probability equal to 1/4 that detector D fires and the bomb didn't explode. So there's no interpretation here. This is a matter of calculation. I didn't explicitly include these detectors in this calculation. To do it properly, you could do that. So an interesting question for this bomb problem is what's the maximum probability that you can let me put it differently. What's the maximum rate at which you can determine that bombs are good without destroying them? I mean, here doesn't look necessarily so good here because you only have 1/4. So even when you don't explode the bomb, which you will do in half the cases, there's still only finding out that you have a good bomb. In 1/4 of the cases, you still have this other 1/4 of the cases that you don't know yet. But you can recycle this to improve the efficiency because the bomb hasn't exploded in this case, so you can just try again. We'll cover. I think it'll be a tutorial assignment. What's the maximum probability you can do? The answer is kind of surprising. Okay, how are we doing for time? So I'll just, in the few minutes that remain, discuss a little bit two particle interferometers. I guess it must be amusing to watch lecturers slowly learn how to use these different blackboards. What's the best thing to do here? Take this one. Good. Okay. So to have two particles, you need a two-particle source. So one interesting example of that is a source which does the following. Has 4 paths coming out. This side corresponds to particle 1. And this is particle 2. This is path A1. This is path B1. This is path A2. So we can there's a way of setting it up. And then there are even some pretty good realistic sources like this, such that S prepares the state. This source prepares the state. A1 A2 plus B1 B2. There's in the third lecture, I'll cover some quantum optics. It's an interesting way of doing interferometers. And there's a process called parametric downconversion, which enables you to prepare exactly this kind of state. And if you do this, then if you have this kind of source, then an interesting experiment to consider is the following one. Okay. So you can see what will happen here is, as you evolve this state past these phase shifters, you'll get phases appear in front of these terms. And then when you take it past these beam splitters, let's just take these to be 50-50. Then it will mix these terms together. And you can do this experiment and get a violation of Bell's inequalities. So this is a test, there's an experiment that's actually been done. And you're able to violate Bell's inequalities with this kind of two particle interferometer. So I won't do the calculation, but
And why do we include the phase shifters
at the bottom? Oh, you know, it's really sufficient just to put them in one here and say here. Yeah. I was putting more in because it's interesting to really see what the dependence is when you do the calculation. But you know, in the experiment, they only put one in two of the arms. Yeah. So if you want to violate a Bell inequality, you need to change something at each end. And the phase shift is the thing you change over here and here. Okay, and then one last experiment. So I'm not doing the calculation, but it's straightforward. One last experiment before I stop, and this comes from one of my own papers. I'm assuming this corner is difficult for people to see. Is that right? Right here, you can't see here. So let's take one of those interferometers. But I'm going to draw it on its side like this. Let's imagine sending into this a positron. OK. So with this interferometer, we know that if we send the positron in here, it will come out where? Yeah, good. Yeah. I think of D as corresponding to dark. Okay, so I'm always setting up the notation so that D corresponds to dark, which I think is the convention that Elitzer and Weidman had in mind. This notation, the U's and the V's and the C and the D is their notation. So we know that nothing can be detected here. On the other hand, if we block, say, path U, then it's possible for something to be detected here. So one way to block path U is to send an electron into this path. And so if this electron and this positron meet here, we're going to imagine that they annihilate each other with probability 1. Okay, so this is a thought experiment, a Gedanken experiment. So we're allowed to do that. Suddenly the unitary transformation exists. In practice, of course, the cross section is much smaller. But so let's imagine that if this positron meets this electron at this point here, then the two things annihilate. So then there's a question, was there an electron sent into this path or not? Well, one way to set that question up is to have a beam splitter here. Okay. So now the electron, it may go this way, or it may go that way. And then we know that if this detector fires, then for sure the electron must have gone this way because the only way for this path to be, the only way for detector D to fire is for this path to be blocked. I'm sort of reasoning very, I'm using words, and that's a bad thing to do in quantum theory, as we're about to see. But for the time being, let me do that. Does that make sense? Okay. So one thing we can say for sure, though, is let me just start to give away where I'm going. I'm just going to reflect this beam here. So if I put a detector in here, let me put pluses on these detectors to indicate that they belong to the positron, and then minuses on everything to indicate that they belong to the electron. So one thing we can say is that D plus implies U minus. If we see a detection in D plus, then we know that this path must be blocked. And so we know that this detector must fire. And this statement can be backed up by a calculation, because it corresponds to actual statements about what we see. Okay. Okay. Let's erase that detector for a moment.
Did you say it must fire?
The reason being that if this detector fires, we know that this path must be blocked. The only way in this setup here for this path to be blocked is if the electron went this way. If the electron had gone this way, so if instead a detector placed here fired, then there's nothing obstructing this interferometer, and so the particle had to come out here. This is just the Elitzer-Weidman bomb argument.
But isn't the electron annihilated?
Well, no, it's the same thing as the bomb.
You detect some sort of...
Sometimes it will be annihilated, yes. But sometimes you won't see an annihilation. What you'll see instead is the positron being detected over here. It's just like the bomb. This is motivated by the bomb problem. Does that make sense?
So this is not the ideal case, then?
This is ideal. The idea is that there's 100%. If the positron goes this way and the electron goes this way, okay. So if inside here we have a positron and we have an electron, we imagine that in 100% of cases, it will be annihilated. But there's also a chance the positron will go this way. Okay, so there's some amplitude for the positron going this way, arriving here. But now, this path has been taken out of commission because it was blocked. So there's no interference. And so it's possible when this positron gets here, it can go to both of these two detectors. And so you can fire here. It's exactly the same as the bomb situation. You can, without making this annihilation effect happen, which is similar to without making the bomb explode, we can still know that the electron must have gone this way. And so, furthermore, if this detector does fire, then this path must have been blocked. And then the only way for that to be the case is if this detector, that must mean this detector is going to fire. So this is true. And this can be backed up by a calculation. I have a sense that that's not completely clear. Maybe in a tutorial, I'll set this as one of the problems. Okay. Okay, so now what we do is we complete this into another interferometer. Now, by symmetry, we know that if this detector fires, and we had placed a detector in here, then that detector must fire. We also know that if we place the detector both here and here, it's impossible for them to both fire, because that would entail these two particles passing through each other en route to these detectors, but they would annihilate. And then finally, if we have no detectors inside here, then we can see that sometimes this detector would fire and sometimes this one would. The probability for that happening, if you do the calculation, is, I think, 1/16. Excuse me. Sorry. Excuse me. Just some water. Sorry, could you ask that question again?
Are those C's rather than U's?
Say again?
The U's, are they meant to be C's?
No.
But where are the...
The idea is that we have detectors that we can place into this path. We have a choice at each end of putting a detector into here. Does that make sense? So at each end, we have a choice of one of two experiments. The experiment where we don't place the detector in the path, and the experiment where we do. I'm assuming, well, does it matter? It does make a difference because it affects the calculation. Sorry, I'm some water. Yeah, it makes a difference because there are four different experimental situations we're considering. The one where you don't place detectors inside, and sometimes you can see this. And then you're getting the full possibility of interference in here. And then the other situations. So if you look at this set of statements, it kind of looks like you have a problem. Because if this can happen sometimes, and this implies U minus, and this implies U plus, then it looks like sometimes you have to have both of these happen. But that's not possible. So it looks like you have a contradiction. Of course, there's no such thing as a contradiction in physics. I mean, quantum theory is consistent, so there's not really a contradiction. But it's telling us something. But I'll leave it there for the time being, before my voice gives out.